Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Viewers, this is the fifth and final episode of the 20th topic. We have been discussing the transmission of the Quran in the previous four episodes. And if you recall, in the last couple of episodes, we have been discussing some of the nagging questions which arise on the transmission of the Quran the way I had presented it earlier on. I had gathered and tried to deduce the fact that the Quran has been transmitted to this ummah by the consensus of the companions and through their perpetual concurrence or tawatur. And of course, when we say this, it's a rather oversimplified conclusion, but there's much more to it, and we had discussed in detail that if the Quran that we have today is the same Quran which was revealed to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and it is the only one which is prevailing in the ummah, then of course there are certain questions which arise on this view, especially in the wake of variant readings and also in the wake of certain countries adopting a whole set of canonical readings, which of course is different to the reading that we had actually said that was the real reading of the Quran, which was called the Al-Qiraatul Amma. We had discussed five questions in this regard. The first of these questions was that what exactly is the origin of the huge corpus of variant readings which is found in our hadith, tafsir, and fiqh books. This was the first question we had discussed. The second question that we had discussed is that why are they regarded as admissible if they fulfill certain criteria? And this also has been discussed earlier on. And the third question that we had discussed and tried to answer was that are the seven canonical readings mutawatir, do they display perpetually concurrent transmission? Then fourthly, viewers, we had discussed that what exactly is the connotation of tawatur transmission in the view of general Muslim scholars, since the canonical readings do not exhibit tawatur. So there was a dilemma that if the Quran is mutawatir, and the canonical readings are not mutawatir, then what exactly is the connotation of tawatur in the view of our traditional scholars? And we had discussed this question also. The fifth question view that we had discussed was that why do parts of some countries have a certain canonical reading? We know that there are areas in this world, for example, in Yemen and in some parts of North Africa, in which a particular area, specific area within the country has a canonical reading on which people read the Quran. So we had discussed this question also in the last episode. Today we shall discuss the sixth and final question which arises, and that is that why do some countries, as opposed to a whole country, as opposed to its parts, have adopted a certain canonical reading? We know that there are countries in this world, for example, Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, Mauritania, some of the other countries as well, in which the whole country is reading the Quran on a set of a canonical reading. So this is the sixth and final question that I'm going to discuss today and try to answer to the best of my capacity. And then, inshallah, we'll go on to draw an overall conclusion to this whole episode, or whole series of topics that we have discussed, in which we have revisited the collection and transmission history of the Quran. So this, once this topic is completed, this subtopic in which we shall discuss how a country adopted a reading, a canonical reading, we will then end this whole lecture series on an overall conclusion. So, viewers, as far as a whole country's adopting a variant canonical reading is concerned, I would first present the case of, in fact, I would only present the case of Nafi Ibn Abi Nu'aym's reading, which is found in some countries of North Africa. I'm going to trace the origin or the how it came to be established and read in a whole country. And the matter of some of the other countries can analogously be deduced. And this I say because Nafi's two students, one of them is Warsh and the other one is Kalun. So both of them are read in parts of North Africa. For example, the reading of Warsh, the Rawaya of Warsh from Nafi, is read in Morocco. And while the Rawaya of Kalun, another student of Nafi, is read in Tunisia, for example, or Libya. So what we are going to cover today is exactly the rise of Nafi's reading, how it came to be so dominant in many countries or some countries of North Africa. And some of the other readings which are found in some other countries can be analogously deduced. Now, viewers, in this regard, I have relied on sources which actually are based on a very in-depth study of the history and times in which readings were adopted in the North African continent and the way they were depicted. I'd like to present Dr. Hind Shalabi. She's a contemporary scholar, and she, in her very incisive analysis in her book, Al-Qira'at bi-Afriqiyya min al-Fath ila Muntasif al-Qarn al-Khamis al-Hijri, she has traced the rise of the reading of Nafi. So I'm going to rely firstly on her data and also present another scholar, because she and some of the other scholars seem to have a consensus on this particular point. So she says that the reading of Imam Nafi, actually the ascendancy of its reading in North Africa, owes itself to two of Nafi's students besides others. There were others, but primarily there were two very prominent students who were responsible for introducing Nafi's reading. So one of them is Abu Abdul Rahman Abdullah ibn Yazid al-Muqri, who died in 212 Hijri, and the other one is Abu Yahya Zakariya ibn Yahya al-Waqar, who died in 254 Hijra. So she says that they were responsible for introducing Nafi's reading in North Africa. She then traces the reason that why was this reading actually so, it became so effective, and how it influenced people so much that the whole country adopted it. And she says that the primary reason for this rise of Imam Nafi's reading in North Africa is itself based on the rise of the Maliki fiqh in North Africa. And the rise of Maliki fiqh is actually based on Imam Suhnoon's efforts. We know Imam Suhnoon died in 240 Hijra. And the result of this ascendancy of Imam Malik's fiqh was that whatever was his preference, Imam Malik's preference, became the preference of that land. So whoever Imam Malik preferred became the preference of that land in various fields. And in the field of Qira'at, since Imam Nafi preferred, Imam Malik preferred Imam Nafi, so therefore it became a reason for people to adopt the reading of Imam Nafi. And I would like to quote in this regard Ad-Dani in his Jami' fil Qira'at, the Sab' al-Mashhura. He says, قَالَ سَيِّدْ بْنُ مَنْسُورْ سَمِعْتُ مَالِكَ بْنْ أَنَسْ يَقُولْ قِرَاتُ أَهْلِ الْمَدِينَةِ سُنَّةِ قِيلَ لَهُ قِرَاتُ نَافِ قَالَ نَعَمْ. Sa'id ibn Mansur said, I heard Malik say, the reading of the people of Medina is sunnah. It was said to him, do you mean the reading of Nafi? He replied, yes. So a very similar statement of yours is also attributed to Imam Suhnoon himself, which he in fact gave as an advice to his son, Muhammad ibn Suhnoon. So he is reported to have said, and this has been reported by Muhammad ibn Suhnoon in his famous book, Adabul Muallimin. So he says, وَيُلْزَمَهُ أَن يُعَلِّمَهُمْ مَا عَلِمَ مِنِ الْخِرَاةِ الْحَسَنَةِ وَهُوَ مَقْرَأُ نَافِ. And this means that it is imperative on the teacher to teach the students what he knows to be good, to be the good reading, and that is the reading of Nafi. So we find Imam Suhnoon also playing his part in this regard, and Imam Suhnoon was the person, as I said earlier on, who was responsible for introducing the Maliki fiqh in this regard. And since Imam Malik's preference himself in terms of reading the Quran was Imam Nafi's reading, so therefore this became a very strong force in the rise of the reading of Imam Nafi. Now, viewers, according to Ad-Dani, it was actually Abdullah ibn Talib. Abdullah ibn Talib, he had actually two tenures as the qazi of Qirwan. So Abdullah ibn Talib, who himself is a student of Imam Suhnoon, during one of his tenures, so one of his tenure was from 257 to 259 Hijra, and the other was from 267 to 275 Hijra. And it seems that it is most probable that in the first of these tenures, he actually would have issued this order, which I'm just going to say, which I'm just going to pronounce. So it is said that Abdullah ibn Talib, who is a student of Imam Suhnoon, during one of these tenures, and I said it's most likely the first tenure, as the Qazi of Kirwan, he was the Qazi of Kirwan and had two tenures, so he directed Abu Abdullah Muhammad ibn Barghus, who died in 272 Hijrah, a teacher of the Quran at the mosque of Kirwan, to teach no other reading than that of Nafi. So this is what is said, that he actually said that only the reading of Nafi should be taught. And in this regard, viewers, I would like to clarify that being the Qazi would almost be like being the ruler of that territory. And it was like a royal decree when a Qazi would say something. It was tantamount to that. So when the Qazi of Kirwan, who is of course Abdullah ibn Talib, he directed Ibn Barghus. And viewers, Ibn Barghus himself was a student of Abu Yahya Zakariya ibn Yahya al-Bakar, who, as you recall, I said, was a student of Nafi, who was responsible for introducing the reading of Imam Nafi. So he was himself, Ibn Barghus himself, who was the Imam of the mosque at Kirwan, was a student of one of the students of Nafi. So when Abdullah ibn Talib directed him to that only the reading of Nafi should be read in the mosque of Kirwan, this received great impetus. And viewers, in this regard, this was actually, I would say, a landmark event, considering the fact, as I said, in those times the Qazis held great sway on the religious milieu of a country. And the words, viewers, which have been recorded by Qazi Ayaz are, Zakara Abu Amr ad-Dani fi kitabihi anna ibn Talib ayyama qazaihi amara ibn Barghus al-Muqri bi jami al-Qirwa Allah يُقْرِئُ النَّاسِ إِلَّا بِحَرَفِ النَّافِ, which means that Abu Amr ad-Dani has mentioned in his book in the time when he was the Qazi, that and he actually, he himself ordered Ibn Barghus, who was the reciter, chief reciter, Quran reciter at the mosque of Kirwan, to teach no other reading than Nafi. And viewers, impetus to this had already been added at the advent of Muhammad ibn Umar ibn Khayrun, who died in 306 Hijrah, when he came to Kirwan in 252 Hijrah. So you can see the dates, that in the first tenure, which was actually 257 to 259 of Abdullah ibn Talib, it is most likely that it is in this tenure he would have given this order, because we know that this is much more likely because of the fact that Ibn Barghus died in 272 Hijrah, and it is likely that this could have happened in the first. Although in the second tenure also it cannot be ruled out. When Muhammad ibn Umar ibn Khayrun came to Kirwan in 252 Hijrah, as recorded by Abu Abdullah Muhammad ibn Muhammad ibn al-Azara in his Al-Bayan al-Maghrib fi Akhbar al-Undulus, Wal-Maghrib, when he came in 252 Hijrah, he actually built a mosque. And he was originally from Spain, but had traveled to Egypt, where he acquired the reading of Nafi from the students of Warsh, Imam Warsh, who died in 197 Hijrah. He then came over to Kirwan. He was also a master reciter of the reading of Nafi. And thereafter, the reading received great impetus. Ibn Furda records, I'm going to cite Ibn Furda, from his famous book, Tariq Ulama wa Ruwat li'ilm bil-Undulus. So he says, قَدِمَ بِكِرَاتِ نَافِعْ عَلَىٰ أَهْلِ الْإِفْرِيقِيَا وَكَانَ الْغَالِبْ عَلَىٰ قِرَاءَتِهِمْ حَرْفَ حَمْزَ وَلَمْ يَكُنْ يَقْرَأْ بِحَرْفِ نَافِعْ إِلَّا خَوَاسْ حَتَّى قَدِمَ ابْنُ خَيْرُونَ فَاجْتَمَعْ إِلَيْهِ النَّاسِ وَرَحِلَ إِلَيْهِ أَهْلُ الْقِيرَوَانِ مِنَ الْآفَاقِ. So he, or of course this refers to Ibn Khayrun, came over to the people of Africa with the reading of Nafi, while at that time the dominant reading was that of Hamza, and the reading of Nafi was found only among the select, illa bi khawas. Until when Ibn Khayrun arrived, people gathered round him, and the people of Kirwan came to him from all parts of the land. So viewers, it is clear from this initial analysis that it was basically the rise of Imam Malik's fiqh in North Africa, and which contributed to the acceptance of Imam Nafi's reading as the dominant reading in some of the countries, and or the only reading in some of the countries, This is because Imam Malik's preference himself was that Imam Nafi's reading is the most correct reading. And he preferred, because he thought that it is Sunnah. And this made other people, when they had adopted Imam Malik's fiqh, they thought that they should also adopt whatever Imam Malik's preference is regarding the Quran. So since Imam Malik's preference with regard to the Quran was Nafi's reading, so this received a great impetus. And as you can see, at one point of time, a Qazi, Abdullah ibn Talib, actually implemented it through a royal decree, as I would say, because, as I said, Qazis in those times held sway on the political affairs of a state, and gradually this became implemented through the state order. So viewers, now I'd like to present another researcher in this regard, and he is Dr. Abdul Hadi Hamito, a contemporary research scholar who basically in his PhD thesis has also outlined seven reasons for the rise of Imam Nafi's reading in North Africa in his thesis, which is called Qiraat al-Imam Nafi Ind al-Maghariba. So I'm just going to summarize those seven reasons before you, and they're also going to appear before you on the screen, so that this conclusion drawn on the basis of some other works, like for example Dr. Hind Chalabi and some of the other people, we are further led to see how Dr. Hamito himself corroborates this view. So the first reason, viewers, that he presents is journeys to Hijaz. He says that many people started going to Hijaz to learn their religion. We know that the reading of Hijaz, it is known that Imam Nafi's reading, it is alleged or it is said, originated in Medina. So he is finding this connection there. So he says that many people started going to the Hijaz to learn their religion and be instructed in their beliefs. Medina was the place of origin of Nafi's reading, and these travels made them acquainted with this reading. So one of the reasons is this, that so people would go to Medina, and the main reading of Medina would be Imam Nafi's reading there. So they started to get acquainted with what the reading of Medina was. And since it was the place where the Prophet, of course, lived for so much time, it had its special importance. They would go there and come back with this reading. The second reason that he has cited, viewers, is that preference for the religion of Medina. So there is no doubt in the fact that being the place of residence of Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the religion of Medina, and as a result, its Quranic reading held special importance before people, which I have just indicated. Such was the dominance of Medina in this regard that the people of Tunisia adopted the riwayah of Kalun from Nafi because Kalun was a Medinite, though West African countries adopted the riwayah of Warsh, who was an Egyptian, from Nafi, yet the tariq they adopted from Warsh was that of Yusuf al-Azraq, who was a Medinite. So you can see how, even though Imam Warsh himself was he was an Egyptian, he did not belong to Medina, but his student, Yusuf al-Azraq, was a Medinite. So the tariq they adopted from Warsh was this one. So this speaks a lot of the importance of Medina in this regard. The third reason which Dr. Hamito has outlined is strong relationship between Imam Nafi and Imam Malik. And the strong relationship of respect and recommendation between the two great jurists, between the great jurist of Medina, also played an important role in this regard. So Malik was indeed a great Medinite authority, and as such was held in great regard by all those who wanted to follow or already followed the religion of Medina. Whereas Nafi himself read out the Muatta before Malik, it is known that Malik read out the Quran to Nafi. So you can see how closely linked these two are. Both are each other's students and respective teachers. So while Imam Malik was the teacher of Nafi in his Muatta, he was the student of Imam Nafi in his reading. So this was such close proximity between the two. This, of course, played its role. Such a recommendation by Malik, because we see that it is reported that Nafi is the Imam of people in Qiraat. We know that this has been reported. And Ibn Mujahid in his Kitab al-Sabah has said this, that it is reported to have said that Nafi is the Imam of people in Qiraat, and that the reading of Nafi is Sunnah. This has also been reported. The first, I would like to correct, was actually reported by Ibn al-Jazari in his Ghayatul Nihaya, when he said that Imam, the people of, the Nafi is the Imam of people in Qiraat. This is what Ibn al-Jazari has cited in his Ghayatul Nihaya. And then we have this statement that the reading of Nafi is Sunnah. This is by Ibn Mujahid. So such a recommendation by Malik of Nafi, and when Imam Malik, a person of the stature of Imam Malik, says that the reading of Nafi is Sunnah, it becomes something of a great push towards the whole affair. So this greatly boosted the latter's reading at all places where Malik was respected and followed. And of course, this is something which is very, very comprehensible. The fourth reason in this regard that Dr. Hamito has pointed out is commonality between initial narrators of Malik and Nafi. So the narrators or students of both these authorities were common initially. The initial narrators of Malik's Muwatta and those of Nafi, who went to Medina and returned to North Africa with the knowledge they had gained, were common. Like, for example, Imam Suhnun and Muhammad ibn Barghous. And this, of course, contributed a lot to the rise of Nafi's reading. The fifth reason which Dr. Hamito has outlined, viewers, is the potent influence of the Qazis on religious affairs. This we have already referred to earlier. The Qazis, or all religious judges, had a very potent influence on the religious affairs of their country. The rulers would follow their edicts and recommendations. They would always follow their recommendation. Thus, in the case of Nafi, both in North Africa and in Spain, the recommendations of the Qazis of these areas in the appointments of prayer leaders and Quran teachers played the pivotal role. Thus, for North Africa, this began with Imam Suhnun, who had directed Quran teachers to teach Nafi's reading to the children. We have already seen this earlier on. After Imam Suhnun, his students and followers continued to exercise this influence, and they include Abu Rabi Suleiman ibn Imran, Abu Khalid Yahya ibn Khalid al-Sahmi, Isa ibn Miskin, Suleiman al-Qattan, Ali ibn Salim al-Bikri. So, as I had said earlier, that whatever the Qazis would say would no less than a royal decree, because the royalty or the king or the rulers were so under the impression and their control that they would adopt whatever the Qazis would say. So effectively, a Qazi would be the power behind the throne. Whatever he would say would be accepted by the ruler and then implemented. And this is exactly what Dr. Hamid has just pointed out. The sixth reason, viewers, that he's pointed out is liberation of the West from the East. The second century witnessed independent empires in Spain and North Africa free from the clutches of the Abbasids in the East. In the case of Fez, which is Fars, of course, in North Africa, this happened with the founding of the Idrisid dynasty at the hands of Idris ibn Abdullah al-Hasni in 172 Hijra. In Spain, this happened with the founding of the Umayyad dynasty by Abdurrahman ibn Muawiyah in 138 Hijra. Both adopted the fiqh of Malik and, as a result, the reading of Nafi. So this, of course, was another thing which became very, very important, because the West got liberated from the East, and we find these empires being independent. And the seventh and final reason which Dr. Hamito has pointed out, viewers, is political and religious unity by the West. So this, a summary of what he has said is that the Umayyad caliphs, Abdurrahman ibn Nasir, who died in 350 Hijra, and his son Mustansir, who died in 366 Hijra, endeavored to bring the whole world, the whole of the West, under their sway. Fez, too, at times came under the Umayyads and at times was ruled by the Ubaidis. A natural outcome of this was that the religion or the fiqh and Quranic reading followed should be uniform. Since the Qazis had already recommended the fiqh of Malik, the reading of Nafi became a formal and official adoption because of Malik's leaning towards it. So, viewers, if you can see how Dr. Hamito has corroborated Dr. Hind Shalavi's view as well, that it was the impetus that Imam Malik provided, or the grounds that he made, that made the basis of adoption of Imam Nafi's reading, because Nafi, as you said, was a person who was preferred by Imam Malik. In fact, Imam Malik, has said that the reading of Imam Malik is Sunnah. So when this was something which was clearly communicated and it became installed in their minds, then Imam Malik was actually, his reading was adopted, I would say, through this, through the edicts of a Qazi, Abdullah ibn Talib. And then, of course, later on, as we see, that this situation continued. And ever since then, the sway which Malikis hold in North Africa is still there. And as a result, Imam Nafi's reading is still prevailing there. And I've described earlier on that there are countries who are on Imam Malik's, one of his students, for example, Warsh, his student, famous student, his reading is adopted by Morocco, and we have Kaloun, whose reading is adopted in Libya. So both are Imam Nafi's students. So these are the two versions which we have traced. Of course, there are some of the other versions as well, but primarily, viewers, it is the reading of Imam Nafi in North Africa, which I have tried to present before you as how this became adopted by a whole country. And as I said, the cases of some of the other countries can be analogously understood, because unless and until there is state interference, it cannot be imagined that a particular canonical reading can be implemented at the expense of the Qiraatul Amma. So whatever enforcement, unless we have the power of enforcement, we cannot obliterate the Qiraatul Amma. So the Qiraatul Amma, whether it was there or not, or whether it was obliterated, can be debated upon. But the fact of the matter is that in the North African countries, the reading of Nafi had become part of the whole country, because it was the edict of a Qazi, and the Qazi himself was, as I said, the power behind the throne. And as I said, this can be further extended to other countries. And as data is compiled and it comes in, we can substantiate to the best of my belief and hope that it would come out in the same light. So, viewers, this brings us to the end of the whole lecture series that we began many episodes ago. In fact, this is the 95th talk, if I have counted correctly. And this brings us to an end, the 20th topic as well, which in other words means that we have comprehensively covered the history of the collection of the Quran, or revisited it and reconstructed it. So before I close this whole discussion, I'd like to bring before you the overall conclusion, although the overall conclusion you can gather it from the last couple of episodes and also some of the material that I presented in the previous topic, but just to present it in a more unified way, let me present before you the overall conclusion of this whole saga of revisiting the collection and transmission history of the Quran. Viewers, in this regard, before I make any statement or a final statement of conclusion, let me direct you back to the initial lectures in which I had actually, or in fact in the earlier on lectures in which I had actually introduced you to the basis or some of the reasons that had led me to this study. So I'm just going to cite what I have already brought before you earlier on, first few lectures. And I had said at that time, and I quote, what then is the need to revisit and reconstruct this history in the wake of these studies? Referring to some of the previous studies. Of course, the question was that since people have been working on the history of the Quran ever since the times of the Prophet, if we can extend it, and various people have made their contributions, then what exactly made me rethink or revisit or reconstruct the history of the Quran? So this is the question that I'm addressing. So the answer to this question, in the humble opinion of this writer, is that most previous works on this topic have been marred by three flaws. They have been marred by three flaws and hence occasioned this recommendation. And now the three flaws. The first flaw is that tools of historical criticism have seldom been fully employed to evaluate the content acquired from the Hadith anthologies on the collection of the Quran. The result was that far-reaching conclusions were at times drawn from data having questionable reliability. So we know that most of this history has been compiled through hadith and history anthologies, which themselves, of course, have content that needed to be sifted out, that needed to be checked for its reliability and authenticity. So what I have done here is reapplied tools of historical criticism on that data, because to me, although previous authorities have applied these rules of historical criticism, but they were not fully employed, I would say. And at times, they were not consistently employed, and at other times, they were overlooked. So it is this thing that has actually made me. The tools of historical criticism themselves, which, of course, are based on a certain research methodology, I had also outlined that in my earlier talks. But that research methodology of yours is exactly the same, is not much different than the one which all Muslim scholars generally follow. The as far as evaluation of a Quranic verse or interpretation of a Quranic verse is concerned, I had presented how I or what my guiding principles are in this regard, and I had also presented how hadith and history, in my opinion, should be interpreted. I had given before you how I follow Ibn Khaldun's guidance in this regard regarding the interpretation of history, and as far as hadith is concerned, I follow the guidelines provided by Khatib Baghdadi, and I cited them earlier on. So this was the first flaw to me, that this is the first thing that actually induced me to take up this study. The second flaw of yours is that the collection history of the Quran has generally been compiled only on the basis of historical reports found in hadith anthologies, or even history ones. Seldom was this collection based on the account of the Quran itself on its collection. So this was entirely disregarded. In fact, as I have repeatedly pointed out before, it was in just recent times that a contemporary scholar like Imam Hamiduddin Farahi, who died in 1930 in India, he actually pointed out some of the verses of the Quran which actually remain in oblivion to the Muslim scholars, and which, according to him, very convincingly tell us and very clearly tell us regarding the collection scheme of the Almighty, because of the fact that the Quran was revealed piecemeal, and there are certain verses of Surah Al-Qiyamah which actually outline this scheme. And unfortunately, this was overlooked. And Imam Farahi, in his monumental research, has shown how the Quran itself speaks on its own collection. So this was the second reason or the flaw which was not this was not these this basis was not covered in the earlier studies, and hence it occasioned the study. The third flaw of yours was that the readings of the Quran transmitted by tentative or zanni means have been regarded acceptable along with its reading transmitted by certain or qat'i means, which is of course the qiraatul amma, which is transmitted by perpetual concurrence and the ijma of the sahaba, against the verdict of the Quran itself. In this way, both have been equated. The variant readings which have been transmitted by the Ahad, they have been equated they have been equated with the Qiraatul Amma, and the distinction between the two has become extremely blurred, if not totally forgotten. So what has happened is that the variant readings which were found in the Akhbar Ahad, about which we have already seen how Imam Shafi and scholars found formed this opinion that they will have to rely on whatever they find in these Ahad reports. So they whatever they gained as a reading of the Quran from these reports was equated to the Qiraatul Amma. We know that the Qiraatul Amma was transmitted through perpetual concurrence and ijma, and thereby yielding certitude of transmission. This was on the one hand, and the other hand we have the variant readings, none of which is transmitted through perpetual concurrence and tawatur and ijma or consensus, and the two were equated and given the same status. So this is the third flaw which has marred our previous researches, and the result is that we are now in a confused situation. Our traditional scholars have since they believe in the acceptability of these variant readings, now we are left to grapple with the fact that how do we justify that the Quran revealed by the Almighty is something of a furqan, in which it is a deciding factor between in religious issues. If this is something to be accepted, then of course these variant readings no longer make the Quran the furqan that it claims to be, the distinction between right and wrong. So I had also said earlier on, viewers, that one very significant reason for these flaws, I had also outlined why is it that these three flaws crept into the studies of Muslim scholars. So I had written that one very significant reason for these flaws in the case of Muslim scholars is their attitude of veneration towards Akhbar Ahad, as I've just said, reported from the Prophet of Islam. It was a towering personality of Muhammad that wielded a potent influence on Muslims because the Quran itself asked them to follow his exemplary character. Such was this influence that instead of taking into account the historicity of narratives that originated from him, many succumbed to the content of these narratives even if they were not reliably reported. So the towering personality of the Prophet, anyone who said that this, I'm speaking on the authority of the Prophet because someone I have heard, who himself have heard, has heard from the Prophet. So these Akhbar-e-Ahad were in this background. The towering personality of the Prophet was such that whenever his whenever a statement ascribed to him would come to the knowledge of people, they would accept it because they would think that people would generally not transmit something wrong. So even if they don't transmit something wrong, the problem of erroneous transmission views cannot be ruled out. So this needed to be checked. But of course, the personality of the Prophet was such that people generally thought that whatever is being reported by people being ascribed to the Prophet is correct. Moreover, in interpreting Quranic verses, these narratives were relied upon even if they defied the text they sought out to explain. So the other flaw is that in interpreting the Quranic verses, in interpreting the Quran itself, it became a principle amongst our traditional scholars to interpret it in the light of hadith, that they would or the Quran would be interpreted if there would be an occasion of revelation or a shan nazul of a verse, they would go for that. And more often than not, even if these narratives, which seem on their face value to explain the Quran, even if they don't, if the research shows that the content itself is not reliably reported, or it has discrepancies, or it has contradictions, or it has certain other criticism, even then, such was the veneration of these Akhbar Ahad that people almost, I would say, almost blindly accepted them as explanations of Quranic verses. So viewers, in the wake of these reasons, I actually embarked upon this study. And I had also outlined a research methodology, which I have just referred to. And I also stated that since this study is based on textual sources, the views of scholars who have rejected these sources are not taken into account. We know that there are revisionist schools, for example, people like John Wansbrough and John Burton and others who have actually not based their conclusions entirely on these textual sources. So they have not been taken into account, although people who are interested, they can read about them in some of my material that I've written. They can get introduced, but I have not taken them up in my study because my purpose was to evaluate textual sources. It was basically a textual study, and the texts themselves was the Quran, Hadith, and history. And viewers, if you also remember that I had outlined 13 nagging questions, which further induced me to take up this study. The flaws themselves, and then these nagging questions coupled, gave me this the tremendous push and inspired me to find out what the truth in this is in regard. Whether I have succeeded or not is something for another matter, which is for you to decide or for people who come later on to decide. But as far as I'm concerned, I've tried my humble best to come up with what I think is the right interpretation or the right reconstruction in this regard. As far as those nagging questions are concerned, I'm just going to briefly outline them. We remember we had the first of them was that there are multiple versions of the Quran. The second was that the Quran has variant readings. The third was that there are narratives which give us the impression of the incompleteness of the Quran. Then we have the fourth question was that we seem to find that there are scribal errors in the Quran. And then the fifth question was that the Usmanic copies were not identical, which when I say this, I of course mean in the copies which Usman made and sent into the empire, they were not identical to each other, which of course is something which raises a question. Then the sixth question was that there was a lack of corroboration from earliest history books. So some of the earliest history books do not have no corroboration of the accounts which hadith books present regarding the collection of the Quran. I had presented before you historical sources, earliest historical sources like Tabaqat of Ibn Sa'd and Ibn Jarir Tabri, who have actually described the events of those times and even described the personalities which figure in these hadith anthologies of regarding the collection of the Quran. But I've shown that that none of them corroborate what these hadith anthology ascribe to these individuals, earliest individuals. Then the seventh question, viewers, was the weak chains of narratives of the collection narratives. The collection narratives, actually, if you recall, all the four caliphs have been attributed these collection episodes. So we have Abu Bakr, Umar, Usman, Ali, رضي الله عنهم أجمعين, all of them being ascribed the collection of the Quran initially, but we had seen how weak their chains of narration were. The eighth question, viewers, that I raised that bothered me and that impelled me to take up this study was there was a difference between the Shiite and Sunni sources, the two main divisions of Islam, in this whole scenario, the collection episode especially. We find the Shiite episodes presenting an entire, Shiite books or resource books presenting an entirely different picture from the Sunni books, especially in the case of the collection made by Ali Ritala Anhu. The ninth question was related to the Quranicity of Surah Falak and Surah Nas. The tenth question related to difference in companion codices. We find presented before you the codices of Abu Ubay ibn Ka'b and Abdullah ibn Mas'ud, reported by Ibn Nadim in Al-Fahrist and by Suyuti in Al-Itqan. We see that they had different surah arrangements. So this question was also one of the questions which inspired me to this study. Then the 11th question was that why is it that the accounts which mention the orthographic history of the Quran these accounts against common sense, but not only they're against common sense, they are also, but also the recently discovered historical evidence or empirical evidence. So it is that these accounts of the introduction of vowel sounds and diacritic marks, which are presented in our source books, not only are they against common sense, but against empirical or manuscript evidence also, which has been discovered recently. Then the 12th question, viewers, was of course, the very enigmatic hadith of 7 Ahruf, of which we had so many explanations, and which explanation is correct or not. This was another question that rose in my mind and induced me to take up this study. And finally, viewers, the question that only four people had memorized the Quran in the Prophet's time. So these were the 13 questions I had, if you recall, outlined in the very first talk that I gave. And although all these answers have been given earlier on in this 20th topic and in the 19th topic, all these nagging questions were raised topically and answered. So I have just referred here to them in a unified way so that you could once again have recourse to the fact that these were the flaws, the three flaws I pointed out, and these were the 13 nagging questions which induced me to take up this study. So, viewers, after employing the research methodology which I had earlier outlined, of course, based on not only these the Quran, the research methodology, but on history and hadith, the result that or the conclusion is the one that now I can state very fairly and squarely in a very humble way, and would like to invite you to critically evaluate it and to definitely, if possible, give me its feedback. So the Quran that exists today in the vast majority of the Muslim Ummah is the very one revealed to the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam 14 centuries ago. It was revealed piecemeal, then collected and rearranged by the Almighty in the lifetime of the Prophet himself and consigned to the Ummah. And this recital in its new arrangement was called Al-Qiraatul Amma, and it was actually something which was called Al-Qiraatul Amma by earlier scholars. It was consigned to the living tradition of the Muslims. It is validated now. It is validated by the consensus of the companions and by their, and it's primarily transmitted by them in its oral form as a perpetually concurrent or mutawatir text in a culture and milieu in which orality was a common medium to communicate literary texts and compositions. And that is something we know that for sure. And later on, as vowel sounds and diacritics were fully added to the script, the written text of the Quran also became perpetually concurrent. So since the diacritics and vowel sounds, they were added later on. So once they were added, the written text also became perpetually concurrent. But still, since it was primarily, initially, originally orality in which the perpetual transmission or concurrent perpetual transmission took place, so that always will hold sway. Now, as far as the variant readings are concerned, of course, when I say that there is only one qiraat, and that's the qiraatul amma, which is found in the whole ummah, then the question regarding the variant readings is concerned. So I would re-summarize it or restate it that many of them are actually remnants of the chronological revelation of the Quran. Many of them are. When the Quran was recompiled, those were disregarded, or their tenses and their structures were slightly changed. And that is why we find very fine differences in some of the readings. Ta'alamun and Ya'alamun, of course, this could have been because once the Quran was recompiled in its new shape and was to give in to the Ummah, the addresses could have been changed or further refined in this regard. Also, faulty transmission and concoction cannot be ruled out, but these variant readings I have already explained in detail all the origin to these causes. And then, viewers, they were regarded as admissible by our scholars because of an erroneous interpretation of Surah Qiyamah's verses, which Imam Farahi has pointed out. They relied on this interpretation of these verses on an asr of Abdullah ibn Abbas, which itself is doubtful whether he himself ever said those words or not, because of the fact that there is an inqita. And also the content is not true to, it does not stand up to the test of historical criticism. And the second reason was that the seven ahruf hadith was regarded to be correct. And one of the reasons for the acceptability of these variant readings, so one was the negative reason, one was the positive reason. And the positive was that our scholars thought that the seven ahruf narrative is sanctioning these variant readings in some particular interpretations. And the other was that they were not able to interpret the Surah Qiyamah verses the way probably they should have been interpreted, disregarding the asr of Imam of Abdullah ibn Abbas, since it has been erroneously ascribed to him. So once they were regarded as admissible, they were regarded as admissible because they were because of the fact that, as I said, the seven ahruf narrative and the absence of any guidance from Surah Qiyamah verses, our scholars were led to accept these akhbar ahad, which contained these variant readings, and so they continued to survive. They survived in our tafsir books, they survived in our hadith books, in our fiqh books. And in some Muslim countries, or as a whole, and in some parts, they practically exist because of reasons that I've already cited in this study. So they were adopted. So admissibility was at the basis. Once they were regarded as admissible, in some cases, or in vast majority of cases, they just survived in those history and tafsir and fiqh books. While in some countries, or in some parts of some countries, in other cases, they were adopted because of the fact that they are admissible. And I've just shown how this was the case regarding Imam Nafi's readings. So this is my conclusion, and I think that the Qiraatul Amma, which is the Quran, on which the Quran we read today in vast majority, is the real Quran, which is found in this Muslim Ummah, and that is the Quran which was revealed to the Prophet himself. And thereby, I would say that the promise of the protection of the Quran, which was made by the Almighty in Surah Hijr, when he said, "Inna nahnu nazzalna zikra wa inna lahu lahafizun," that it is we who have revealed this zikr or this Quran, and we are its protectors. Or made in verse 42 of Surah Mu'min, which says, "La yatihil batil," which means that, of course, the verse goes on to say that evil cannot infiltrate from behind it or form in front of it. So these were this was a promise from the Almighty, and I think that this promise has been fulfilled in all periods of time. The only problem is because of the fact that we have seen how these variant readings have arisen, and thereby this this promise of protection became under jeopardy. But I have explained that this, of course, is not the case as far as my humble study is concerned. So, viewers, I would thank you for bearing with me for these 95 sessions on the history of the Quran. It's a very humble contribution to this subject. Of course, being a human endeavor, it cannot be fault-free. It must be inflicted with flaws. I would be very grateful if you could give your critical feedback, and it will be very happily viewed by me. I would definitely take a very, very deep look into it. My email address is now being displayed before you on the screen. Please do send your feedback to me if you have. And I also thank all my teachers, which I have already acknowledged very earlier on, who have guided me all through in this study and in my written thesis and written book as well. And lastly, and not by any means the least, I would like to thank the Almighty and would request Him to guide me to any blemishes and oversights that I may have committed while making this study, and to make this study a starting point of rethinking the history of collection and transmission of the Quran. Thank you very much. أَقُولُ قَوْلِي هَذَا وَاسْتَغْفِرُ اللَّهَ لِي وَلَكُمْ وَلِسَائِرِ الْمُسْلِمِينَ وَالْمُسْلِمَاتِ